Namadeva Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate 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 Vasudevaya.
The title for this evening's discussion has been given as the key to transcendence. Before speaking on this, I will also thank you all for coming here. Often, thanking people for attending is a polite formality, but I mean it. Because the very fact that you're coming here to hear about the key to transcendence means that you have started on the path to transcendence, because the key, well, I'll get into it in more detail later, but first of all, understanding that if we're talking about the key to transcendence, that means that we understand that there is transcendence beyond our day-to-day humdrum existence. There is a higher platform of consciousness, and there is a key. Well, of course, we're not talking about a literal key, but we're talking about a method to attain that, which means that it is something external to us. It is something to be applied in our life, and it is something we need to learn about. So the very fact that you're coming here and listening means that you're making the first step, because it's an admission that we're not on the transcendental platform. It's something that we need to attain, and that we need to learn how to attain that. Now, myself speaking about this, it might seem that I'm sitting on a high, not literally, but taking a high platform and saying, well, I know and you don't, so I'm a hell of a lot better than you. But it's not like that. I consider myself very fortunate to have the unwarranted mercy of my spiritual master, who very kindly taught the ancient system of attaining transcendence. Ancient means that it's authorized, time-tested. It's not like in modern life where we think that something which is new is always better. The latest car, the latest iPod, iPad, whatever, this, that, and the other. It must be better than previously. But we're talking about eternal principles, eternal knowledge, that which doesn't change, that which doesn't need to change. It's already completely perfect, and in all generations, that knowledge is applicable. So, first of all, what do we mean by transcendence? What is the meaning of this term? There may be different people have different ideas about this. I'm going to speak about Krishna's idea. Krishna is accepted in the culture of transcendence. I'm talking about India's culture, that culture which focuses on transcendence as Paramam Purusham Divyam, which means in English, that can be rendered as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and as Yogeshvara, or the master of all systems of yoga. So what Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita is accepted by generations of persons who are very serious about transcendence, because when we're talking about the key, we're talking about a methodology. It's not, the key is a very, gives the idea of a simple process. You stick it in the lock and you turn it. But We as complex beings, we're not so simple that just simply put a key in a lock and put a key in and change everything like that. We're very, very complex beings. So Krishna is accepted as the master of yoga by generations of perfect persons, and his teachings in Bhagavad Gita are the essence of knowledge about transcendence. So that's another key, or another factor in the key to transcendence, is knowledge of transcendence. First of all, we have to know what transcendence means. What do we mean when we say transcendence? We may imagine this or speculate about that, but in Bhagavad Gita, which is the summary of all knowledge, it's the summary of all the Vedas. Veda means vidya, which means knowledge. Knowledge here doesn't mean something that someone experiments about and then someone comes along later and does another experiment and proves the previous experiment wrong or not fully perfect, but knowledge means knowledge that is fully perfect in all respects. So that is the knowledge of the Vedas. And Krishna presents that. So there is knowledge. The key is knowledge of how to approach that. And transcendence, what does it actually mean, transcendence? That is described by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita, that in material existence, we are all in the illusion that is called Maya, and that illusion is impelled by what are called the three modes of material nature: sattvagun, rajogun, and tamoguna. These are three dominant forces on our consciousness which keep us in illusion. Tamogun means the mode of darkness or ignorance, in which some symptoms of tamogun are, well, there are two basic divisions in tamogun. One is very active, but violent, nasty. When we see, for instance, or we hear about the killing fields of Kampuchea, or the torture and extermination, genocide of people, or the genocide that goes on in the slaughterhouses of the so-called civilized world, such as this country, on a daily basis. This is a manifestation of tamoguna, the mode of ignorance, in which suffering, the suffering of others, we don't care about. Another symptom of tamogun, ignorance, is indolence, sleep, don't give a damn about anything, don't care whether you live or die, don't care for your health, just, all right, let me eat something, doesn't matter whether it poisons me, or let us frack the countryside, it doesn't matter, it's going to pollute everything, as long as money gets in my pocket, what the hell does it matter? So these are symptoms of tamoguna, the mode of ignorance. The mode of passion, it means that people are very active for material gain, for sense gratification. They want to enjoy through their senses, seeing nice things, touching nice things, smelling what they feel, hearing what they like to hear, working very hard to attain these things. The United States of America is practically the epitome of rajoguna, the mode of passion, with a good dose of tamogun thrown in for good luck, or more likely bad luck. So that is a summary of rajoguna. And sattvaguna is another mode of illusion. Now this might surprise you if you don't know about it. It's another mode of illusion in which people are inclined to be detached from this world. They're inclined toward spiritual life. They're inclined to lead a peaceful, introspective life, not to harm others, to cultivate spiritual knowledge, that is also a facet, or can be a facet, of illusion. If someone thinks that, well, I'm very good, I'm very spiritual, but they don't have the actual path of spiritual knowledge, and they're content to be good, very nice, very peaceful, very ecological, but they imagine themselves to be very spiritual, but they don't have actual spiritual connection. Yoga means connection. That's the literal meaning of the term. And in the spiritual context, it means to link with the Supreme by the process of, the process of yoga is meant for linking with the Supreme. So the key to transcendence means to go beyond, that's the meaning of transcendence, and in the spiritual context, it means to go beyond the material platform, beyond the three modes of material nature, and come to the spiritual platform. So what is the spiritual platform? We may think, well, in the material world, there's activity, there's interaction, so on the spiritual platform, there is no activity and no interaction. That can be true on the beginning level of spiritual understanding, or the beginning level of transcendence. But the full platform of transcendence is described in Bhagavad Gita. The key, what is the method by which we can come to the platform of transcendence? Krishna in Bhagavad Gita instructs his disciple Arjuna in various facets of spiritual knowledge and various misunderstandings about this material world. He instructs about karma, he instructs about yoga, he instructs about dharma, and in one chapter, chapter 14, he discusses the effects of the three modes of material nature, and he concludes that chapter by giving, in brief, the key, the method, to become free from the effects of the three modes of material nature. Therein he says, I'm quoting the Sanskrit, which Krishna spoke and is well known among serious transcendentalists up to the present day. Mang chayo viha vicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samatityaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. Krishna says that persons who perform avyabhicharini, this means without deviation, fixed, focused, concentrated, bhakti yoga, you've probably heard these terms, bhakti and yoga, those who perform undeviating bhakti yoga unto myself, Krishna says, such a person, sagunan, he becomes free. Sagunan samatityayan. This literally means he becomes transcendental to the modes of nature and attains to the transcendental position. So this is the key to transcendence is bhakti yoga. There are other processes of yoga which are discussed in Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is a yoga shastra. It is a shastra means authoritative spiritual knowledge. There are various shastras, dharma shastras. They instruct us how to live and act in this world in a moral way, more than moral, in a manner that is moral and in harmony with the purpose of the universe. So Bhagavad Gita is a yoga shastra. It teaches us, Krishna teaches us about yoga. So in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks about karma yoga, the yoga of living in this world and acting in this world for the sake of upliftment. Of course, everyone who lives in this world acts in this world. But karma yoga means to act in a particular way for the sake of upliftment. Jnana yoga means to concentrate on knowledge, of specifically knowledge of transcendence, and in this way try to become free from the effects of illusion. So this is very important. Why should we even want to be transcendent? Why? What's in it? What's the great thing? Well, as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, and actually any discerning person can understand this, this world is miserable. Notwithstanding the more or less pleasant climate in California and the what is called the high standard of living, people are miserable, in case you hadn't noticed. And the attempt to become free from misery is the whole activity of everyone in this material world, not only humans, but all living beings. If we examine, we can see that not only humans, but every living beings, including the plants, everything they do at every moment, they do for the sake of maximizing their happiness and minimizing any forms of distress. But, however much we try, we have to suffer in this material world. And Krishna points out, janma mrityu jaravyadhi dukkha. There are four kinds of distress that we have to suffer. We cannot avoid it, even if we're... we've got all the money we want to be happy and healthy body and good looks and everything that anyone might desire, but we have to undergo birth, death, old age and disease. We might not undergo old age, we might die young, but that doesn't mean we're any better. But certainly in other lives we're going to, and disease no one can avoid, even from minor ailments such as the cold cough and raspy voice that I'm presently undergoing, to much more serious diseases. And undoubtedly, everyone present here has suffered disease and will suffer disease. And this will go on, life after life after life, suffering in various ways. So the quest for transcendence is actually a symptom of intelligence. One, a person who is trying to be happy in this world is a fool. I'm not just saying that, but I'm saying it on the authority of Krishna, who states that in Bhagavad Gita, and actually it's a fact, that utkramantam sthitam vapi bhunjanam vagunanvitam vimurha nanu pashyanti pashyanti jnana chakshushaha. Krishna says that people who do not see how we are changing from body to body and how we are situated in our present bodies according to our previous karmic reactions, actually Krishna doesn't say they're fools, he says they're great fools, just to be more linguistically correct. They don't see this, but one jnana chakshusha, one who has the eye of knowledge, he sees. So jnana is an important word. If we're going to make a serious study of, if we're going to be serious about transcendence, we have to understand the techniques and the methodology which many, many persons in the past have trodden this path, what they have understood. So jnana, there's jnana yoga, which jnana yoga, the yoga of knowledge, that begins with understanding that this world is material, but everything here is temporary, it is full of suffering, but I am eternal. I am not meant for suffering. I am meant to be out of this situation, to transcend this situation. So that is an important start. But Krishna says, bhakti yoga. By bhakti, which means unflinching devotion to Krishna, one automatically transcends the three modes of material nature and comes to the spiritual position. So this is actually the key. If we're going to talk about the key to transcendence, if we're going to give one process, that is bhakti or bhakti yoga. Now, like so many other words in English or any other language, bhakti is a term that is often misunderstood, especially abstract terms or terms which describe a complex genre. So bhakti is an often misunderstood and misused term, and as it's entering the English language, now in the process of entering the English language, as the words karma and yoga, for instance, have entered the English language during my lifetime. When I was born, those words weren't in any English dictionary. Now they are. So now the term bhakti is entering. And like the words karma and yoga, the word bhakti is being misunderstood. But it's not just Sanskrit terms that are misunderstood. Practically all the abstract terms are misunderstood. Just like the word love is misunderstood, the term compassion is generally misunderstood and misapplied. The word intelligence is often misunderstood and misapplied. So bhakti, in the definition which Krishna gives to it, and which the great acharyas or spiritual teachers, spiritual guides, spiritual masters have understood, bhakti means unflinching devotion to Krishna, understanding Krishna to be the supremely transcendent, loving person, and that we are his eternal subordinates, servants in a loving relationship. And this, for many people, is a put-off. Oh, I'm a servant of someone superior to me. Many people, from the beginning, they just can't accept this. But then, we can't be transcendent. If we don't accept the method, then we can't be transcendent. I'm going to sidetrack from the general line here. Transcendence, we should also understand, means to become free from our material attachments and from the bad qualities that we have picked up in our sojourn of many, many lives in this material world. There's another verse in Bhagavad Gita. I'm quoting the Sanskrit because that is the traditional authoritative system to show that I'm not just speaking off the top of my head, but I'm speaking that which is approved, that which is accepted by authorized teachers throughout the ages. So there's another verse in this regard from Bhagavad Gita. Vita raga bhaya krodha manmaya mamupashritaha bahavo jnana tapasa putamad bhavamagataha. You might have noticed that word jnana again, knowledge. So Krishna says that being purified of material attachment, material fear and material anger, many, many persons in the past, by knowledge and austerity, attained to my nature. So to come to the platform of transcendence means to become free from all the bad things in our heart, which are generally listed as six main ones, but there are plenty more also. The six main ones are karma, material desire. Material desire is that which binds us in this material world. It binds us to birth, death, old age, and disease. We get body after body after body because we have desires to fulfill. For instance, if someone wants to be a leader, that's a common desire, that they'll be honored by others. So, if they don't have the piety in this life to become a leader of humans, because it's not just desire, if one has pious activities, he can become a leader. That we understand that the President of the United States of America, in his previous life, must have executed some pious activities to get such a point. I'm not saying he's executing pious activities now. I don't want to enter into a political discussion. But he must have done something pious with the desire to be a leader. Now, there are many people who desire to be a leader. Twice he won the election, so the persons who were opposing him didn't get the same result as he did. So he must have had more pious background. So it's desire. Because we have a desire, we get born. So someone may have the desire to be a leader, but not have the piety to become a leader among humans. So they may become a dog, and among a pack of dogs, they become the most prominent. And in this way, desire propels us from one body to another to another. From material desire comes anger, krodh, the word anger. That also means frustration, discontent. We have desires. If they're not fulfilled, we become frustrated. We may become angry. And if they are fulfilled, we also become frustrated because we don't get the happiness that we thought we would get from fulfilling them. And therefore, we desire again and again something else. I desire to have a big house. I got it. I'm not happy. Okay, let me get another big house. And bigger. And I desire to have a nice car. Then I would a bigger car, a better car. And it goes on and on and on and on and on. So kam, krodh, lobe, greed, to surround myself with material objects, to get more and more and more. Kam, krodh, lobe, moha, illusion, mada, pride, to think I'm so great, I'm so wonderful. And irsha, hingsa, matsarya, envy of others. So this all binds us in the material world. Krishna says that we can get free of this, but we have to follow the process of bhakti yoga. The beginning of that is to accept that I am very tiny. I'm eternal, I'm spiritual, but I'm very tiny. And there is the supreme eternal spiritual who is very great. And I have to submit myself in love, because that is the nature of transcendence, love. The supreme eternal person is Krishna. He is full of love. We submit ourselves to him in trust. Bhakti can be translated as love, as devotion. There is a process of bhakti. It begins with humility. Not artificial humility, but accepting that I'm in need of help, I need guidance. I need to submit myself. I don't really know who I am or where I am or how I got in this mess, but I need to make a solution to this repeated birth and death. So bhakti begins with shravanam, hearing all these topics, and kirtanam, chanting the names of Krishna, which we just did. And there are other processes also. Hearing and chanting about Krishna that solidifies or matures into remembrance of Krishna in love. Just as in this material world, a person is in love, they cannot but think of their lover all the time. But in the material condition, love for someone else wears off. But in Krishna consciousness or pure spiritual love, it simply increases all the time. unlimitedly. That is the blissful position of transcendental love, which is the goal of, and which is the process of bhakti yoga, the yoga of loving devotion to Krishna, which is the key to transcendence. Obviously, it's a big topic. It's not, like I say, it's not just taking a key and turning and it's finished, but it's a process that we have to apply in our lives. It may take many lives, or we can perfect the process in this life if we're sincere. Practically, if we have to say one word, what is the key to transcendence? That is sincerity. So, Hare Krishna. Thank you for kindly listening. And if anyone has any questions, comments, or protests, now is the time. Yes, please.
Yeah, I was taken by your linking the word pious to political leadership. You said probably in a past life you had a pious devotional nature. I would
excuse me, I just need to differentiate here. Piety and devotion are not necessarily the same thing.
Okay, well, could you talk about
piety? In the teachings of Gita, Upanishads, actually pious activities are not recommended, if you can imagine that. Pious in the sense of, let me do something good so that I get a good result later. I'll do something good. I'll feed people. I'll, in the Vedic culture, digging wells so that people can get water to for all different purposes. That would maybe be a good idea in California. You might have to, nowadays, you might have to dig pretty deep. Planting trees on the road so that when people walk along the road, they get shade. Going to holy places, these are all considered pious activities. But generally they're executed with the idea that by doing this, I will go to heaven. In the Vedic understanding, there is heaven, not the heaven which is described or imagined in Abrahamic systems. But it means it's a place within this material world where you go for a long time and enjoy a lot. There's no IRS. There's no droughts. It's you have a long life. Everyone is very beautiful. Everyone is very cultured. Everyone is very intelligent. Everyone is, cultured, I said that, well-behaved. So they're not all the time fighting with each other. So that is the idea to do pious activities, and one will get a good result. And when one comes back, because you have to come back, it's like building up your bank account. You work, you get money, and then you say, okay, now I've done enough work, now I'm going to enjoy. Let me spend all the money. But there comes a time when your bank account is empty. So what happens is you can go to heaven, spend a long time there, enjoy yourself a lot, and you have to come back again. But when you come back again, you have you don't come with a totally empty account, but you still have some measure of piety. So people like that, they get born in places like California. Not everyone who's in California has got such a pious result, but the four symptoms of piety in a previous life, the four principal symptoms are Janmaishvarya Shruta Shri, which means good birth, birth in a well-to-do family, opulence, born with a silver spoon in your mouth, Shruta, intelligence and high education, and Shri, bodily beauty. So someone may have all these things due to their previous punya, but punya or pious activities, they don't actually purify the heart. Or they may do to a very incremental degree. So because the propensity to enjoy this material world is there, which involves dominating others, exploiting others. So someone who has performed pious activities, they may get the opportunity to have a high position, but when they do so, what comes out is the tendency to dominate and exploit others. So then they start acting in a very impious way. Because now I got the opportunity, I can dominate others. So this is how the cycle of birth and death goes on. One is in a miserable condition. He thinks, well, I should perform some pious activities, be good. Then at least in a future life, I'll have a better situation. So he performs some pious activities, gets a better situation. When he's in a position to dominate, he thinks, oh, okay, now I am on top of others. He acts impiously, he performs sinful activities, and he goes down again to a miserable condition. And this way it goes on and on and on and on. But transcendence means to see I'm caught in this cycle and to cut out of it. To cut out of pious and impious activities. That doesn't mean that one stops acting, but one has to act on the transcendental platform, which means in its ultimate manifestation to serve Krishna with love. So that's that in brief. You can understand, like I say, it's not such a simple matter as saying Om and thinking now I've transcended. We're dealing with our own very complex psychologies and our own very deep material attachments, which go back literally millions of births. You can understand, to understand all these things, which actually the 14th chapter begins with Krishna talking about transcending. Then he talks in the beginning of the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Highly recommended that you study this Bhagavad Gita as it is. He talks about the process of becoming detached from the very complex situation in this material world. It's compared to a banyan tree. If you go to India, you can see, well, in Hawaii, I think they have, maybe in California also, banyan trees.
They trim them, though.
They keep them trimmed. Yeah, but a banyan tree can spread over literally acres, and you can't tell where did it begin, because it starts and then it puts, it's unique in as much as from a branch comes down a branch, which goes in the ground, and then that becomes a trunk. And it one tree is like a forest. And you can't understand where it begins, where it ends. So, and it's extremely complex. So Krishna says, take the sword of detachment and knowledge and cut it. Anyway, like I say, it's somewhat complex. But the simple process is simply to devote ourselves to Krishna.
I just was kind of asking about the mode of goodness. Isn't it said that in order to actually begin the process, one at least has to reach the mode of goodness?
Yes.
Yourself from the mode of goodness.
Yes, generally the mode of goodness is...
And
yeah.
Mode of goodness, what are the symptoms of mode of goodness? Cleanliness, truthfulness,
yes.
Austerity. And without that, you can't really launch yourself.
Yeah, thank you very much for the clarification. The mode of goodness, sattva-gun, as Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita, it can be binding, but it can be also the platform on which one embarks on the process of transcendence. So it depends a lot on how we take it. In sattva-gun, one will tend to be clean, regulated, detached from this material world to develop good qualities. So these are all conducive for entering into actual spiritual life. But if one becomes caught up on that platform and thinks, well, I'm already there, I already made it, then we're still in illusion. One has to go beyond merely being moral, clean, regulated in our activities and actually come to the understanding of Krishna. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna also says, sattvam sanjayate jnanam. From this platform of sattva-gun, the mode of goodness, comes knowledge. So when one actually develops knowledge, then he understands that I am the eternal servant of Krishna. That's the full manifestation of knowledge.
So Shuddha Sattva is what's higher than...
Yeah, Shuddha Sattva, that means the platform. Sattva literally means existence. And Sattva Gun means that quality which is our real existence. It's close to our real existential quality. That we have lust, greed, anger, envy, illusion, pride, that's not really us. It's a covering. So Sattva Guna, that brings us close, to our real pure existential position. And Shuddha Sattva is the platform beyond the modes of material nature, in which one is completely free from all illusion, and one is situated in one's transcendental, spiritual, constitutional position. That is Satchitananda. You've probably heard this term. Sat means that which is eternal. Chit means full consciousness, clear consciousness. And Ananda means spiritual bliss, full bliss. So that's what we're really meant to be like. Yeah.
One more.
I think you should come here. You have many things to clarify.
Can you describe the symptoms of somebody, the symptoms and activities of someone who's situated in that transcendental platform, the Shuddhasattva platform?
Someone who's situated in the Shuddhasattva platform.
How does that person behave? How can you recognize that this person...
Well, that's right there in Bhagavad Gita, isn't it?
Yes.
In the...
Just
prior to that. Where is that? Amanit Vamba Dambit Vamma Hingsak Shanti Rajavam, etc. Well, yeah. Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna gives the general sin. Interestingly, the first two qualities are Amanit Vamba Dambit Vam, which are almost synonyms. And that's in the 13th chapter. This is in the 14th chapter. Yeah, this specifically. There's a series of four verses. I'm just going to give the English translation. The conclusion of it all, Gunatita sa uchate. Such a person is beyond the modes of nature. He who does not hate illumination, attachment, and delusion when they are present, nor longs for them when they disappear. This is a very interesting. This will require a lot of discussion. I mean, Krishna speaks in Bhagavad Gita, and Arjuna understands it. And for us to understand it, we're going to have to take many lifetimes, or at least quite some time. That even when we get illumination, we get realization, but we don't think, okay, now I made it, I'm so wonderful, I'm so great. Nor do we reject that. We take it as a gift. Who is seated like one unconcerned, being situated beyond the modes of nature, beyond the reactions of the modes of nature, who remains firm, knowing that the modes alone are active. This is very important, because in our life there are so many things that happen to us which we can't avoid. Just like to give another very mundane example, I presently have a cold. I didn't want it. I can't stop it. It's there. Okay, go on with it. Just don't get hung up on it. And that's easy with a cold. Maybe not so easy with cancer. That doesn't mean don't try to treat it, but you understand that material nature is acting on my body. I am a spirit soul. I am transcendent to this. This cold or this cancer, it's not me. It's just the body. It's the modes of nature working. Who regards alike pleasure and pain. Well, let's see. If we're transcendent, if pleasure and pain we take to be the same, It mentioned in Bhagavad Gita is Janak Maharaj as an example of a perfect karma yogi. So the example given about him is that in both material pleasure and material pain, he was completely unaffected. The example was given, he could have one hand in fire, that's painful, and the other hand on the breast of a woman, that's pleasure. Material pain and material pleasure. But in either circumstance, he's unaffected. Not so easy, is it? We shouldn't prematurely consider that we are...
Don't go home and try.
Don't do it here either, we'll get sued. I might get sued. Who looks on a clod, a lump of earth, a stone, and a piece of gold with an equal eye? Who is wise and holds praise and blame to be the same? That's a tough one. If you praise me, I'll be very happy. If you insult me, I won't be happy. But a self-realized person takes them to be the same. Who is unchanged in honor, who treats friend and foe alike, who has abandoned all fruitive undertakings. In other words, he's not out to make $1 million. Such a man is said to have transcended the modes of nature. So that's a generic description of the person who is transcendental. That's at the end of the 14th chapter.
So does that mean if you see gold, you should just walk past it? Or you should use it in whatever way?
If we see gold, well, if it doesn't belong to me, then it's got nothing to do with me.
No, but isn't it...
If you give me gold, I'll give it to someone to sell, and I'll use the money in Krishna's service.
So is the name... Is Yukta Vairagya?
Yukta Vairagya means, yeah. If you give me gold, or if you don't give me gold, I should be the same. If you give me gold, I won't start jumping up and down and being happy and think, now I can use it to enjoy myself. Whoops, I shouldn't use myself as an example. Well, maybe I should. I'm supposed to be practicing this. Yeah, we shouldn't be elated. If you give me $1 million, you're welcome to do so if you like. It won't change my life. I'm not going to buy a Mustang and drive around on the highways. Anyway, can't go on 65 without getting pulled up. But it's nothing for me. If you give me gold, it's nothing for me. I can't be benefited by it. There's nothing inherent in gold by which I can be benefited. But I can use it in Krishna's service for instance, cooking food which is offered to Krishna and distributed to people like yourself. So for ourselves, a transcendentalist for himself requires nothing. But he's willing to, if money comes his way, he can use that in Krishna's service. And if nothing comes, he'll chant. If money comes, he'll chant Hare Krishna and use that money to spread the message of Krishna so they can also join in chanting Hare Krishna. And if no money comes to him, he'll chant Hare Krishna and just tell others. He's not affected. Just like Srila Prabhupada, before he came to America, he was a pure devotee of Krishna. He was preaching Krishna consciousness, telling others about Krishna for their benefit. He was fully absorbed in love of Krishna. After coming to America, after many months of struggle, followers came, money came, he used it to print books, to hold festivals, to enhance his propagation of the message of Krishna. But he remained unaffected. He was still the same pure devotee of Krishna. He was in the transcendent position.
Was he in good health when he first landed? Was it in New York?
When he first landed in America, was he in good health? Not very. Yeah. He was 16. He was 69 years old. And at that age, unless one has been practicing a rigidly Hatha Yoga, you can't expect someone to be in very good health. So our aim of life is not to be in very good health. Physically, his health was not very good. Spiritually, he was in perfect health. So the apparent physical condition of a perfect bhakti yogi may not be very good. He's not attached to the body. In whatever condition he's in, he goes on serving Krishna. That is his perfection. Not having a very fit body is his perfection, but the fact that he uses his body in sickness or in health to serve Krishna, that is his perfection.
So spiritually, he's transcended the lower, what would we call maybe the ordinary lower thing.
That is the symptom of his transcendence, that in all circumstances he goes on serving Krishna without being affected by material happiness or distress or sickness or health or poverty or wealth, not being affected by wealth. He doesn't care.
He's eternally happy.
He's eternally happy because he's eternally linked with Krishna, who is supremely happy.
Beyond the physical.
Hmm?
Beyond the physical.
Yeah, beyond the false quest for happiness in this material world, which results in misery. So if we're talking about a key, but then I said that I've been saying that the keys may be a little more, maybe the analogy is not such a simple, not such a straightforward analogy, but because we are complex beings and the process of bhakti, it deals with us, so it's not just flicking a switch. But if there is one key in this modern age to transcendence, by modern, in Vedic terms, that means for the last 5,000 years, modern, because we know that time goes on a long time, and with all due respect or disrespect to Charles Darwin, and we understand that, well, time and human and life on this planet has been going on a lot longer than they might teach you in the college and university. And in fact, all ancient civilizations discuss the cycles of time of mankind. Anyway, the modern age, it's the Kali Yuga, the age of quarrel, hypocrisy, confusion. But in this modern age, the key to transcendence is chanting the names of Krishna. That is the one simple process by which we can all be immediately lifted to the spiritual platform. We had a little of that already, and with your permission, we could have a little more.
Yes.
Not too long.
No.
In this world, we're also constrained by time.
Well, I was going to say, I know people are anxious. Let us serve
prasadam. Prasadam, and who wants to take prasadam can take.
Juan, I don't know. Are you going to take prasadam now?
No.
Okay.
Well, I'll take milk prasadam if it's there.
Okay. I'll let you serve that. Usually at this point, first of all, thank you very much, Maharaj.
Hare Krishna.
We're hoping that some good